Previously on the Audiophiles.
Felix Pappalardi was a founding member and a producer guy in the band Mountain. Mississippi Queen was their big hit. In 1983, Felix Pappalardi was shot in the neck with a derringer by his wife, with whom he had an open marriage. She shot him after he came home early in the morning from his girlfriend's house. Now, apparently, and I'm not an expert on those things. I've done some shit, but I've never been in an open marriage. Apparently, there are degrees of open when it comes
to... Well, openness is fluid. Let's say that.
Chins up, boobs out. It's showtime.
Time for music.
Civilized conversation.
Wherever the music takes me, kitten.
Scott Edward Phelps.
Ah, yes, the legendary wit, or at least half of it.
Dave Simmons.
Good evening, Dave.
Can we not talk about sex so much?
Tell you right out, I'm a man who likes talking to a man who likes to...
Talk about...
Most important music show ever.
Cue inspirational music.
The Audiophiles.
And in the end,
I see dead people.
Game over, man. It's game over.
They're dead. They're all dead.
So let it be written. So let it be done.
It's go time.
Last week, we talked about auto crashes. We talked about pop music murders. We talked about a couple of two or three of rock and roll's more memorable mysteries. Coming up, we complete our little shuffle off the mortal coil salute with a few oddities and some snappy songs to go along with stories of self-infliction this week. And in the end, it's go time part two. And first up, we'd like to all think that we'd be willing to take a bullet for the family. But it turns out that depends largely on where the bullet is coming from. Friendly fire, family fire. Either way, not such a good thing. Right now on...
The Audiophiles.
It's a family affair. Bang, bang.
He was a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. He had three of Rolling Stone's 500 greatest albums of all time. He won a Grammy for the best R&B vocal in 1983 and the best R&B instrumental that same year. He was given the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award in 1996. And in 1984, in the heat of a family squabble, his father shot him to death, supposedly fearing for his own life. As with Sam Cooke, we talked about last week, whatever really happened pales in the darkness of what other musical greatness might have come from the unequaled Marvin Gaye. You know, unsavory exit notwithstanding, it occurred to me when I was throwing together that little medley, and I was around in the day, I was a kid, 1965, 66, when Marvin came along and the early Motown hits and those kinds of things. But here's something, and we talk about this a lot on our little show here, and it's always risky because it always ends up sounding, or it's too easily sounding like critique or being snobby or old fogey about contemporary music. But the latter part of Marvin Gaye's career, and I did a run through this morning, and I was listening to the last couple of songs, "Mercy Me" and "What's Going On?"
Yeah,
and you know the word that popped into my mind, the best word was important.
Yes,
that music was important. They were important songs about important issues in a time when attention needed to be drawn to those important issues by it, and not everybody did it. There was a lot of lightweight, fluffy crap, just like there is at any other given time.
Right,
but that's absent without leave currently, to my way of thinking, unless I'm overlooking somebody who's...
Yeah, it's weird. When we had our record deal with Atlantic Records, they encouraged us to do a cover. And I'll have to dig it out. I've got a copy of it somewhere. We did What's Going On, and we did Ooh, baby. Yeah, is that the name of the song?
Smokey Robinson.
Yeah, Smokey. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. We did two covers just to give them something to pick from.
Right.
But even when we were tackling the What's Going On, it felt important, and we were just covering somebody else's song. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a song that touched you deep, you know, no matter at what point you listened to.
Well, he took his career in that direction intentionally, yes, because that's what he was feeling. And, mm-hmm, and in order to make the backstory and context correct, you got to remember this was in the late 60s into the early 70s, pushing the mid 70s. And the Vietnam War was hot and heavy, and there was a lot of conflict, as if there's never any.
Campuses were, you know.
But look back as late as early even as the 60s when Sam Cooke did, A Change Is Gonna Come.
Yes.
Again, yeah. Important music, mm-hmm, important songs, important artistic expression about important issues, and right, it just makes so much of what's being done by so many, not everybody, but so many, just trivial.
Yeah.
Let's make the bucks. Let's have the group. Let's do the thing. And once again, the big asterisk, that kind of stuff occurred then too. It's not right, like that was a golden age with no mistakes in it, but that's what's missing in the soul of music nowadays.
I actually think we're not saying that it doesn't exist today. It's just not mainstream. I'm sure there's artists out there, independent artists, that are writing important songs about important issues.
Oh, there always will be.
Yeah.
Because there's always some poet out there who's just being a poet and doesn't give a shit whether they go gold or show right, up on the talk shows.
But those things aren't finding their way into the mainstream like they used to.
Too much, maybe?
Yeah, I don't
know. There's so much stuff now.
That is true.
There was no interweb back in those days. There was no streaming. There were just AM and mostly AM radio stations, yes, and then buying records. Just an observation.
But you know that little, you know, montage of music that you did, it made me hot just like an oven.
We'll be right back after this word from our sponsor this week, Saltpeter.
You're listening to the Audio Files.
What are the odds?
Astronomical.
Yeah. All right.
I couldn't resist. I'm sorry.
That's okay. If it feels good, do it. You're just expressing important issues. It's not so much about what are the odds. It's about who are the odds, as in oddities, present company obviously included. And there's no study of human behavior. I need my NPR voice here. No study of human behavior would be complete without a scholarly look at the events on the mankind timeline that are usually referenced under the category, wow, that is some weird shit. Or at the very least, why, how odd.
People are strange.
Strange days indeed. Most peculiar, mama.
That is so odd.
All right. This melange, a 40s hitmaker with a baton in one hand and a little too much Sominex in the other. A 70s pop star who was flooded. No, not fan mail, just flooded. A teen heartthrob who proved beyond doubt that the skies might be friendly, but mountains, not so much necessarily. And let's never forget that a tree can turn on you. Just like that. Or vice versa. Yeah. Wow, this is some weird shit.
What good would it do?
You know where I can be found, don't you know? I'll be waiting by the telephone. I'm a fool, just a silly fool, to be in love with you.
Easy to make you marry.
Flowers in her hair, flowers everywhere.
I'm
the
flowing on the ground.
First up on our hit parade back there, Cats and Kitties, was the 1940s, early 1950s bebop and big band sound of the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra and their biggest single hit of ever in all times, I'll Never Smile Again, featuring their front and center. They didn't call him lead singer in those days. They called him just
band leader.
Band leader, vocalist. Their vocalist, though, whether it was male or female. That was a very young Frank Sinatra who sang the lead on that track. Tommy Dorsey, though, was a big band leader of the time. He and his brother Jimmy Dorsey. And, of course, there was Evelyn Dorsey. No, that was a girl I knew. And let's see, Dorsey Burnett, different family. Anyway, Dorsey was this big band leader, very successful. Singles hit, gave Sinatra essentially his start. And that song, I'll Never Smile Again, was their big, big single hit. Mr. Dorsey had a habit of taking sleeping pills, but not in the later, more contemporary, dramatic. They were on the road a lot. They didn't have a lot of access to amphetamines and speed and shit like that in those days. So he took pills, sleeping pills. Well, he was also a pretty appetite guy. He wasn't a heavy-set fella, but they traveled a lot. Well, you know what's coming. He had himself a super big meal. Now I'm sleepy. And he took his sleeping pills, and he did a little Jimi Hendrix meets Mama Cass and choked on his big meal right there.
You know, when I looked him up, because obviously I knew that Tommy Dorsey, I didn't realize they had 286 charting singles on Billboard.
Yeah, they were the rage.
Amazing,
baby. I know.
I think it was like 18 number ones.
And you know, that's my parents' generation of teen listening,
right?
But I've always had a sentimental. I like it. There's something that whole period and that most of that music,
Glenn Miller. It was soothing.
It was fun. It was harmless. And there was World War II was going on. Nazis and Japs were trying to kill everybody. So it wasn't like it wasn't an idyllic fairyland, but it was just, you know, there's that. I'll Never Smile Again. I was sadistic fellow that I am. I was thinking if we threw together an idea for a sequel hit these days now, I think we would call it I'll Never Swallow Again. You know what? That didn't deserve a laugh. Let's do this.
Well, I kind of got tuned in early to that era of music because of Gene Krupa.
Right.
Gene Krupa is known as the first flashy drummer.
Well, he was the Hal Blaine of the big band era.
Mm-hmm. He played everywhere. And later on in life, at the end of their lives, Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich and Elvin Bishop would line up in a straight line and duel.
Sure.
And it was some of the coolest stuff. You can find it on YouTube, guys. It's some of the coolest drumming stuff that I've ever seen.
Is it Krupa or Buddy Rich? I think it's Buddy Rich. The one I saw not too long ago was actually one of those one against one on one of the variety shows of the 1960s, but it was Buddy Rich and Sammy Davis Jr.
Yes, yeah.
On the drum kit.
You know who did a good one? Do you remember Ed Shaughnessy? He was the
Tonight Show drummer. Tonight Show, sure.
He did a drum off against him, and that was phenomenal. I was like, oh, my God.
That's right.
Yeah, those guys could play, man.
They were true musicians, not just celebrities. Dean Paul Martin was the son of Dean Martin. He was also the Dino in Dino, Desi, and Billy, which was a successful 60s group. 1965, I think, was when I'm a Fool first came out. You know what occurred to me? Somebody else said this to me a long time ago, and I had forgotten it, but then I was triggered by old memories. I think Dino, Desi, and Billy count as the first boy band. If you think about the context of a boy band, because, I mean, the Beatles were already around and there were bands with boys in them, but it was like these guys didn't write their material.
Right. They were manufactured.
Yeah. They did play their instruments, but that was it. They sang their songs.
And they predated the Monkees by a year or two.
Yeah.
You know, because the Monkees are generally considered one of the first boy bands, too.
So when they finally put together the Boy Band Hall of Fame, Dino, Desi, and Billy will be in there.
They should be.
The Monkees will be refusing, but that's the way
they
go. Well,
they can't get into any Hall of Fame.
Anyway, Dean Paul was his name. They called him Dino. Desi was Desi Arnaz Jr., who was the son of Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz. Still is. He's still alive. Billy Hinchey was just a childhood chum of theirs who grew up, went to high school with him. I had the chance to, I talked to Billy Hinchey two or three times back in the early 2000s phone interviews. He was just a funny guy, very talented, sweetheart of a guy.
He sat in on a talk show with me for like two years.
By marriage he was related to Carl Wilson of the Beach Boys.
Oh, okay.
His sister married Carl Wilson, and so he was a backup. He was kind of the John Stamos
Of his time.
Of the 1960s. He played keyboards for the Beach Boys while he was doing his other stuff, and then he just passed away last year, kind of.
Yes, I remember reading about
it. I think it was cancer they discovered on Tuesday, and on Thursday he was gone. But
that's the way to happen.
There you go. Anyway, as far as Dino was concerned, He was a tennis pro for about an hour and a half after the musical career. He was married to, briefly, to the actress of the day named Olivia Hussey, who doesn't, but baby boomers will droolingly remember. She played Juliet in the 1968 version of Romeo and Juliet. Do the Google, guys. You'll go, wow, she was really pretty. That marriage didn't last. He was married then to Dorothy Hamill, the skater with the cute little bob haircut, who was everybody's charming lady back in the day. He also dated, wink, wink, Candace Bergen and Tina Sinatra. Well, hell, he was Dean Martin's son, so you run with that crowd. Nevertheless, he finally got himself a real gig, and he became a captain, or he became an officer in the National Guard, and he was promoted up to captain. He was a pilot, jet pilot, doing training. And in 1987, he flew his trainer right smack into the side of a California mountain and was killed instantly along with his co-pilot or trainer associate or whatever was in the back of the plane. And that's not an oddity necessarily, but, and I've mentioned this in passing before, but it just, I have a dark sense of humor about dark things like dying. And it just cracked me up because I thought, this is the government at work. This is your tax dollars and how they work. And part of the reason the bureaucracy is the way it is. I got a chance to take a look. It was online somewhere or somebody showed it to me. This is not a big deal. It's not classified information. The flight report, the incident report on the accident
that killed the crash.
And NTS or NTB or the National Guard or whatever. And it had his name on there, Dean Paul Martin, Captain, blah, 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 yada, yada. And then in the little box where it said cause of death, hand to God, it said limited flight into terrain.
Yes. They said at impact, the jet was going over 400 miles an hour.
Yeah, I don't think they saw the mountain. That's, you know. And they needed Donovan at that moment. First, there is a mountain. Then there is no mountain. Then there
is. You know who his life paralleled?
Whom?
John Kennedy Jr.
A little bit.
Somebody that was good at everything he did. Famous parents.
There's no report, though, that he was flying recklessly.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying
people telling
the type of life he lived until, you know, and then they had a very similar end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, interesting point, you need to be aware of this. I mentioned that he was married to Olivia Hussey. He was married to Dorothy Hamill for 2 years. He dated Candace Bergen and Tina Sinatra. None of them ever flew with him, which is why I think that this moment all four of them are around. But then again, I did some research. None of them have ever yet shopped at Earl Teat Music.
So they're not going to be here for long.
So TikTok. And the Rain, the Park, the Other Things, that was the Cowsills and their big hit from the 1970s. Barry Cowsill of the Cowsill family. And this isn't an oddity, but it sort of kind of is. On my birthday, and I don't think that the hurricane did this to celebrate my birthday. On my birthday in 2005, that's the day Katrina hit the city of New Orleans. And saying that it hit is understating it. If you're there, you know, and all the rest. It was a massive, just massive. Cowsill and his sister both lived in New Orleans at the time, but Cowsill decided not to evacuate and decided to weather the storm in an abandoned warehouse. He survived the storm, but he needed help, so he called Susan, his sister, from a payphone. They had her family had chosen to evacuate, and he left four voice messages saying he was surrounded by looters and people shooting. Now, Susan Cowsill later said she didn't hear any of the messages until September 2nd. And Barry was never heard from again. But after an extensive search, it was December, about a few days after Christmas, later that year, that his body was found under a wharf on the Mississippi River, and they subsequently identified him by dental records. His death was attributed to drowning as a result of the flooding following Katrina. But it is the old, if it's not odd, then it's almost kind of Twilight Zone-y. He was scheduled to fly to Los Angeles to enter alcohol rehab because he did have a substance abuse problem. Right. He was scheduled to leave New Orleans to fly to L.A., wait for it, on the morning of August 29th, 2005, when all flights were canceled because of Hurricane Katrina.
Right. Yeah.
Now, and it's also important, I think, just to throw in for whatever that we're having fun banding this around. Of course, we take tragedy seriously. Okay, but it's also, this just goes to show you that at the end of the day, it's the old, they all put their pants on one leg at a time, just like we do. These performing celebrity artists, stars, superstars, they're just people subject to the whims and whimsies of Mother Nature.
It's the randomness of life that's going to get you.
It's also the randomness of life that makes it sweet. And if you believe that shit, then you're a lifetime subscriber to Lifetime Television.
You're listening to The Audiophiles.
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
That's right. And speaking of limited flight into terrain, he was an award. He was an award-winning producer and songwriter. He co-wrote the big 60s hit Needles and Pins that Jackie DeShannon recorded and the Searchers did at one point. He was a TV show host, half of a husband-wife duo who made hit records, did a TV show, as I mentioned, and even made a really bad movie together they did. We'll talk about that in a minute. Oh, and trivia buff, heads up. I didn't know this, and I'm always impressed when I run across things at my age that I didn't know, because I figured by this point I knew everything. Under a pseudonym, he co-wrote an early album cut by the Rolling Stones. And much to our chagrin, back in the day, he himself actually stepped out on his own as a solo performer just once during the heyday of Sonny and Cher.
I never thought I'd cut a record by myself, but I got something I want to say. I want to say it for Cher, and I hope I say it for a lot of people. Son of a gun now, so I don't care. Then laugh at me if that's not fair. I have to beg to be free. Then baby, laugh at me and I'll cry for you. And I'll pray for you.
I remember that record because I was 14 years old the year it was released. And I have to tell you that to this day, I remember that that for me was the origin of the phrase, wow, does that suck?
he's really using the Bob Dylan affect really.
Ineffectively.
Yeah, it's just...
Well, he can't sing, he can't dance. Yeah. He was a great straight man on the Sonny and Cher show.
He was a fairly good writer.
He was a good writer, you know? and he was a genius marketing guy. He took that duo and...
Well, he made Cher.
Oh, no question about that.
She wouldn't have been anything without him.
Turns out, though, he wasn't much of a skier.
No.
January 5th, 1998, flying down the slopes at, ironically, here we go, Heavenly Mountain Resort in South Lake Tahoe, California. And then suddenly... there was a tree.
Yeah.
Talk about, at least Dean Paul had a plane around him when he hit the side of the mountain.
I think he was pronounced dead on the spot, wasn't he?
Well, yeah. Yeah. Because I think he'd been going full tilt and just, it wasn't like he came around a corner tried to dodge it or so. Apparently he just ran like a Warner Brothers cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
If he'd been Wile E. Coyote, we would have laughed and he would have dusted himself off. Yeah.
The odd thing about that is at that point in his life when he did that, he was a senator.
Congressman.
I'm sorry.
He became, after the music thing, after he and Cher split up for real, he went on and he became, I think it was Palm Springs. He was the mayor of Palm Springs for about an hour and a half or a term or whatever. And then he got the ambition to go to Congress, and he did. Mm-hmm. And he was in, I think, one full term and maybe another year.
And
apparently he was really good at it.
Yeah.
And
when his seat vacated, his wife took it over.
Mary Bono was elected to fill the remainder of the seat. She was elected in her own right 7 times before she was defeated in the election of 2012.
Yeah, and he's got an act. It's called the Copyright Terms Extension Act of 1998, which is named after Sonny Bono, that his wife sponsored and passed.
What was the extension?
Extended the term of copyright by 20 years.
So now it's 40 years?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, darn, there goes my chance to grab the Taylor Swift stuff when it comes into public domain.
Yeah, and it was named in honor of him 9 months after his death. So
there's a ski joke there, but I'm not going to do it. All right. This top tier guitarist went fishing on Old Hickory Lake. I've been there in Nashville. He came home and he apparently fell asleep in his living room with a lit cigarette. A house caught fire. He was rushed to Vanderbilt Hospital where he died 2 days later. He's buried in Hendersonville Memorial Park. Hendersonville is a suburb north of Nashville. Actually, that's the first place that I and my little band group and I lived when we first moved to Tennessee.
Not Hendersonville?
Yeah, Hendersonville. It's up there. That's Roy Orbison. Old Hickory Lake is the lake where I talk about Roy Orbison's house on the lake and, uh-huh. and Johnny Cash and June Carter live next door and all that. That's where Hendersonville is. It's kind of a, it's not like a Beverly Hills. It's not that ornate, but it's more of a,
you know, upscale.
A little upscale. Yeah. Than that. Anyway, that's where he's buried. And he's buried next to the graves of the husband and wife team for whom he played guitar, Johnny and June Carter Cash. His name was Luther Perkins, but besides.
And his, no relation, by the way.
Interestingly enough, his Cash connection, besides that, he's almost better known, and he is around here, for having played a pretty fun part in the history of Hey, Hey, They're the Monkees.
Oh, pick it, loser.
Now, that's from Papa Jean's Blues.
Blues, right.
And we talked about this on a show or two or three. When I was a kid, and that song, was that on the first album or the second?
Very first album.
Okay. Dave is the resident monkey ecologist.
What had happened is they didn't let Mike Nesmith do any of his songs, and he put up such a big stink that right. they gave him money and said, go produce your own songs away from our studios. So he yeah,
stopped being a monkey. Be a
he
monkey.
Did Papa Jean's Blues, and on the first album, what was the other one? It might have been A Girl Like You.
I can see the label, but I can't remember the song.
But he did two songs of his writing, and he produced them, actually.
When he did Papa Jean's Blues, I was there, and I don't mean the session, but I got the record and was listening to it. My sister had the album, and I'm listening to it, and I hear this, and I swear to God, and this is a Mondegreen. We did a whole show at Mondegreen's. Mondegreen is an expression or a piece of a lyric or something in a song where you think what you're hearing is not what you're actually hearing. Famous Mondegreens include Excuse Me While I Kiss This Guy. There's a bathroom on the right, the Creedence Clearwater.
Hold Me Closer, Tony Danza.
There you go. This Mondegreen
was... He'll never bone you.
This Mondegreen, which Dave made that an exclusively legendary thing. I've used that several times in several shows. I swear to God, I heard it when I was listening to the record the first time back in 1966 or 67, whenever it was, and I thought he was saying, and all my friends did too, Pickett Wilson. Because Wilson Pickett was a great R&B success right. back in those days. And it sounds like he's saying, Pickett Wilson, if you hear it for the first time. But what he was in fact doing, Mike Nesmith, was a little shout out to the guitar player for Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash, Luther Perkins. What he is saying is, Pickett Luther. All right, listen again.
Oh, Pickett Luther.
You see, when you know what it is, you hear it. But when you don't know what it is, it sounds just like Pickett Wilson. Now, here's your bonus trivia. After Luther passed away, Johnny Cash asked an old buddy of his, Johnny Cash's, to take his place, take Luther's place in the band. And off and on for the next 10 years, he did that. Which is interesting because it's a guitar player you might have heard of here and there through the years. But he was kind of, I think, semi-retired at the time, and he'd had a little success of his own. He was also a Perkins. His name was Carl.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready. Now go, cat, go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoes. You can do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoes.
The longer version will be available on our sister podcast, The Audio Files.
Now, this is a little off topic. What do you think his career arc would have been had he not been in that bad accident?
Well, I don't know.
Wasn't that kind of why Elvis took some of those songs and made them?
It's exactly the reason why Elvis took the songs. Elvis had already recorded Blue Suede Shoes and realized Carl was going to do it and put it aside. Then when Carl was injured and couldn't get it done, Elvis issued. I'll tell you the difference. There's no question about, in hindsight or in maybe rose-colored glasses, about the quality of the work that Carl Perkins created. I mean, the Beatles were so influenced by them that they recorded Honey Don't and Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby, and all kinds of people have recorded Blue Suede Shoes
for ages. Right.
But the X factor in your question to me would be Carl Perkins
wasn't
an unattractive man,
right?
But he wasn't Elvis.
Elvis, well, who was really?
Yeah. And his presentation was he stood up on the stage and he was affable and he sang his songs and there you go. But he wasn't Elvis. The Elvis thing was magical,
yeah,
in that magical sense. So the chances are, who knows, but Carl probably would have had some success with his songs. I don't see him becoming a big superstar.
Yeah, probably not.
Probably not on that level. Yeah. But unfortunately, he died.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, and I was reading this and about Luther Perkins, our dead guy.
Well, they're all dead now.
He and Merle Travis were the fathers of that boom chicka boom style of guitar,
mm-hmm.
where you mute the bass, the top three bass strings, the A, E, and D,
mm-hmm.
and you know, just syncopate on the muffled lower strings. And he's one of the ones that made that Johnny Cash sound so different than everything that was out there at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? I went through during the run through this morning, and I've known this, all this stuff we're talking about, I've known most of this for like 50 years, but it never dawned on me before, because sometimes you don't pay attention to the most obvious things. And maybe that's what you were alluding to a minute ago. I said, well, it was Johnny asked Carl Perkins to take Luther Perkins' place. And for the first time, I was today years old when my brain went ding. Perkins.
Yeah, that's why I said no relation. Yeah.
I had never, I've known all about this, all this stuff for years, but it never dawned on me until this morning that, oh yeah, look at there.
That's like in modern day times, that's like the Taylor brothers in Duran Duran. They're not brothers.
Right.
John Taylor, you know, the Andy Taylor and Roger Taylor, no relation.
And Andy Taylor is no relation to the Andy Taylor of Mayberry either. Because there is no Andy Taylor of Mayberry. He's fictional, for God's sake.
Two guys who know tunes, talking tunes. The Audiophiles.
Suicide is painless. It brings on many changes. And I can take or leave it if I please.
You may or may not have known that the theme song from MASH actually had a lyric that was written for it.
Yes, I did.
And the quick story on that is the guy who directed the movie was a guy named Robert Altman. And they commissioned a song to be written for the movie. And they wanted it to be about suicide. And they said to Altman, get the song. And Altman said, I'm a film director. I don't know squat about writing songs. But his young teenage son was an aspiring songwriter. So Altman turned around and said, here, kid, do something with this. And the kid wrote the lyric. The music was written by a professional movie recording music guy. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. That was the melody, but the kid wrote the lyric in like half an hour,
mm-hmm.
and they put it to the song, and they released it, and they did the thing. And Altman told the story for many years after that. He said that as a director, he made like $700,000 back in the '70s directing the movie, and the kid to date has made like $3.3 million in songwriting royalties for knocking out the lyric in half an hour. So, kids, the moral of the story is, of all the oft-spoken old sayings that are told, one that is oft-just told is the observation that if you want something done right, do it yourself. Well, apparently, that goes for often yourself as well.
So long, farewell, I'll be to say goodnight.
You've probably never heard of him, even though Paul Simon wrote a song about him. Let's just say when it came to gunplay, he wasn't exactly aces. Keep that in mind. The thing about being a one-hit wonder is that fading away from the one hit can be depressing, not to mention fatal, even if it's a tropical paradise hitmaker. This guy accidentally, doing my finger quotes, shot himself in California, but he was best known for Illinois hitmaking, kind of, sort of. And talk about the best of times, worst of times. This 60s song guy saw several, not just one, and it's not Carl Perkins, but several songs of his recorded by the Beatles. And then he brought his own life to an end with a cliche bang bang to the brain. Did that make him a bad boy? His story and those others, right after we enjoy the music that made them all memorable.
Forever, my darling, my love will be true. Always and forever.
Romance, Lord, I, baby, now you're moving with
right, in the order in which we just listened to them, the little slow dancing guy's got his hands on the girl's ass cheeky song was called Pledging My Love. It was 1954. Johnny Ace was the name of the singer. The song, it's a Paul Simon, it's an album cut. He didn't make a single out of it. He wrote a song way back called The Late Great Johnny Ace, and he talked about the suicide in a poetic fashion. The short version of the story is that Ace was one of the first type that put himself out by basically saying, oh, yeah, don't worry, the gun ain't loaded, everything's fine, watch this, ha-ha, put it up to his head, pull the trigger, and bang, there you go. Now, interestingly enough with this, I'm looking at the blurb here from where I think I got this off of Wiki. His bass player said, I'm going to tell you exactly what happened. Johnny Ace had been drinking. He had this little pistol. He was waving around the table, and somebody said, be careful with that thing. And he said, it's okay, gun not loaded, see? And he pointed it at himself, and he said, bang. Big Mama Thornton was also in the room, and she ran out of the room yelling, Johnny Ace just killed himself. Now, you may not know, or you may, but you're about to, that Big Mama Thornton is the songwriter lady who wrote Hound Dog.
Oh, yeah, you're
and
right.
It was originally, well, as a rule, because I look stuff up. And, she wrote that, and she was part of that whole circle. And she had been, she said that Ace had been playing with the gun, but not playing Russian roulette. He pointed the gun at his girlfriend and another woman, but didn't fire then. He pointed the gun toward himself, bragging that he said which chamber was loaded. The gun went off, blah, blah. Now, according to his biographer, he shot himself with a .32, not a .22, and it happened a little after an hour in a new Oldsmobile. Who knows? It's one of those kind of things. But they, and there's several other instances of, or coming up with another one here in a minute. There seems to be something in the superstar or celebrity music star DNA that says I can screw around with guns and put them up to my head and pull the trigger. And
remember Elvis used to shoot out the TVs and
the only thing Elvis can be credited for is that we're not aware of any time where he actually put the gun towards himself and put he just cheeseburgered himself to death. But that's a whole different story. But Johnny Ace, the stuff is interesting. It's kind of archival, and he was a pioneer in early R&B and early pop music. So you should check him out. The second tune was Whoa, 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 Montego Bay. Speaking of shotting himself, Bobby Bloom was the name of the singer, the artist. 1974, at his home in Hollywood. He was just 28 years old. Bloom had shot himself while cleaning his gun. The surviving members of the family said, no. But interestingly, there was never any further investigation.
Yeah, they never looked into it. They said he was in. He walked in on his, it was over a girl.
Yeah, Jeff Barry is a well-known songwriter, or was a well-known songwriter back in the 1960s. We may end up doing a little piece on him one of these days because he's written a lot of songs that would make you go, oh, yeah. He was apparently a friend of Bobby's, and he said in an interview, interestingly enough, Jeff Barry, was the sole beneficiary of Bloom's life insurance policy and told folks in an interview that he was shot. Bloom was shot in a fight over a girl. Said Bloom burst into the room after kicking down the door and was then shot. The case was never followed up. You know, it's one thing to show passion for your lady, and it's another thing to show bravery in terms of taking on the guy who may be messing around with your lady. It's another thing to be really stupid and kick a door in without knowing what's behind the door.
And just like my granddaddy told me, you'd rather just shoot the woman once than a different guy every week.
You get a peewee for that.
We have another Monkees connection.
Okay.
Bobby Bloom wrote Do It For Love off of the single off of Changes, that last album with Mickey and Davey. That was all that was left of the Monkees.
No kidding.
Yep.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Did he say Pickett Luther in the song?
No, he didn't.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of being dumb and playing Russian roulette, let's talk for about 10 seconds about Terry Kath, who was a founding member of Chicago Transit Authority, which shortly became Chicago, because it was cooler and didn't sound quite as geeky, and it was easier to print on the label.
And who discovered Chicago? Jimi Hendrix.
Let's see. There you go. All right. The usual blurb here. Let's see. He began to play with his guns, spun his unloaded .38, put it to his temple, pulled the trigger. His buddy warned him to be careful. He picked up a 9mm, said, don't worry about it. Look, the clip is not even in it. And showed him the empty clip, put the clip back in the gun. Put it up to his temple, pulled the trigger. Unbeknownst to Kath, wait, you know where this is going. There was a round in the chamber.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised nobody's ever written a song called Round in the Chamber, because there's a whole long litany of those idiots that do that. He died instantly. He was 31 years old. You know, if you're going to take the clip out to make sure that you're safe there because there's nothing in it, you have to kind of remember it's like in the spy movies where they grab, or cop movies where they grab those things and go the top and they pop that bullet out of there. You got to check that place too.
Yeah. The crazy thing about that, I saw an interview with the drummer of Chicago, Danny Seraphine. Was that Seraphine?
Close enough.
Something like that. He said that Terry was extremely unhappy in Chicago and
in the band, you mean?
In the band, and he was very depressed as well.
Well, he took care of that, didn't he?
Well, he was doing a lot of drugs at the time and alcohol. But there's an interesting documentary. It's called Chicago, the Terry Kath Experience.
Okay.
And it basically, his daughter did the movie. I watched it probably a couple months ago. It's all about her trying to learn about her father because she was an infant when he killed himself.
Right.
And during the course of that, he had, do you remember the Telecaster, the famous Telecaster he had that had the pig nose stickers all over it?
Sure.
That was a famous guitar. When he died, disappeared. Nobody knew where it was.
Well, opportunity knocked for somebody.
Well, no, actually a road crew guy from one of Chicago's road crew guys shipped the guitars to his parents' house.
Oh, really?
At the end of the documentary, she's trying to find a guitar. She's going to different people who she thought might have that guitar.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the closet of her grandmother's house.
Yeah.
And the grandmother's like, yeah, we thought when you got the right age, we'd give these to you. And it was two guitars. One of them was the pig-nosed Telecaster.
Well, I'm sure you can look forward to them coming up on a future episode of Pawnbrokers.
But yeah, it was a really good documentary. Well done, because they interviewed her mother, who spent all that time with him. And just a real fascinating. He was an interesting guy, great musician.
Yeah, he was.
And they said he didn't want to be in a horn band.
Yeah, I know. I've always been on the fence, and it's painful because the picket little sticky in the ass and all that. But as I get older, I get more struggling with things. And I'm fortunate medically. I've got little minor dipshit stuff going on, but I don't have anything major going on in my life with that problem, and I'm grateful for that. But at the same time, you know, there's been lots of times in my life when I said, for a variety of reasons, when I've said, you know what, fuck this, I want out. So and the older I get, the less compassion and less sympathy I seem to have for people. Yeah, you're depressed. Go get some help.
Right.
Okay. Boo-hoo, poor guy. And yes, money's not the most important thing, but, you know, having a certain celebrity, having pretty much anything you need and want and can do so many good things with it and just say, boo-hoo, I'm tired, I'm going to play Russian roulette and kill myself. It's kind of like, you know what? Good for you. You did the world a favor.
Yeah.
Because you're just a whiny little bitch.
Wow.
That's the mood I'm in today. Tomorrow, I may be Mother Teresa, but at the moment, it's just, you know, everybody, I remember these kids that I was working with. I love these kids that I work with at Tower Records, but I was kind of their manager, big brother slash guy when Kurt Cobain killed himself.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have thought that it was Dallas and JFK all over again with the kids in the back room. Oh, my God, I can't believe it. Did it. I said, for the love of God, man. You know, the guy was troubled, and that's, you know.
He was addicted to heroin.
Yeah. So, anyway, finally on the Hey, Let's Shoot Ourselves list here, and I mentioned what a guy. At least three of his songs were recorded by the Beatles in their early days. Bad Boy, which I mentioned a minute ago. Dizzy Miss Lizzy. And that song that you heard the excerpt of, Slow Down. Larry Williams was his name. And he was a pioneer. He did a lot of performing himself, very similar to Johnny Ace of that period, the late 1950s, very early 1960s. According to experts or professionals on the scene, he was 44. It was originally deemed suicide, though there was speculation that he was murdered because of his involvement with drugs and prostitution. There were no suspects, blah, blah. He's
buried. Sounds like a party.
Yeah, he was found by his mom. It was 1980. He was 44 years old, and it's tragic, but, you know, not so much.
You're listening to Scott Edward Phelps, Dave Simmons, The Audiophiles.
But wait, there's more.
All right, here's another one of those. This is kind of interesting, from a dead suicide, maybe not, maybe so. And this goes along with, I was going to do a little fun Guess Who with Dave, but I thought, you know, he endured that shit for like 2 years, so we won't do it again. So I'm going to do it with you all. As you're listening, you've no doubt heard this song somewhere along the way. It is, I'll just tell you, it's a piece from the original Broadway play and movie West Side Story. It's called America. I like to be in America. So you've probably heard the song. You have very, very, very unlikely heard this band, and you have almost assuredly never heard the guy singing it at the front of the band. It's a little version of America. Listen to it, and then we'll tell you the story.
I like to be in America. Oh, if I meet in America. Everything's free in America. What is for free in America?
You know, one of the fascinating things to me when I was a kid, and it's happened in other realms since then, and this is a perfect example. People who are British, the Beatles, for example, when they sing, it's kind of like Mel Tillis with an accent. Mel Tillis did not stutter when he sang.
No.
Stuttering was an affectation of his speaking voice. People from, and almost pretty much any language, but mostly in Britain especially, and we learned from the English when the Beatles came along, they all had very pronounced British, even lower working class Liverpudlian
accents,
almost
yes.
Cockney yeah. accents. Mm-hmm. But in their singing voices, there's not a hint.
No.
There was no hint of a British accent right there just now. And that right there was a guy who is inexplicably or interminably, I can't come up with the adverb, tied to the Beatles history. That's Rory Storm, who was the head of Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, which was the band whose drummer in the early 1960s was a fellow by the name of Richie Starkey, who was recruited by the Fab Four to become Ringo Starr. Rory Storm disbanded the Hurricanes. He became a DJ.
At a roller rink.
At a roller rink. You see, it could have been worse. He could have been doing commercials for diabetes medication.
Ugh.
He developed a chest infection, could not sleep properly, took sleeping pills. On 1972, Storm and his mama were found dead. The postmortem said he had alcohol and sleeping pills in his blood, as had mama, but not enough to cause his death, which was ruled accidental. Although it could not be proven, it is thought to this day that mama apparently took her life after she found Rory's body. Oh my gosh, kind of a mama Romeo and Juliet sort of thing.
Yeah, well, he had to move back home and basically quit his music career.
Well, he never hit it big.
Yeah. No.
He's a footnote in history. There's no question, but it didn't.
Which is odd because
monetize.
They were the biggest band in Liverpool.
That's right.
I mean, bigger than the Beatles.
Yeah.
So the depression of all that building up, you know, he probably just took his life.
Well, sure. Maybe.
And DJ at a fucking roller rink. Come on, man. That's enough to make anybody.
There's
wanna
pride in every work. These guys. And this is my cheap joke for the show. These guys should have been the ones to record Hang On Sloopy, or maybe the Four Seasons Let's Hang On, or perhaps even the Monkey Song. What am I doing? Hanging around. You're going to know why that's funny and tasteless in just a few seconds. But first, Dave has all the demise details coming up in exactly 1 minute and 9 seconds. Now, a quick note for all you youngsters out there. If you're very knowledgeable about pop music and you're being all snarky and looking at the person that you're with saying, man, listen to that band doing that really sucky version of that great Harry Nilsson song. Well, hush up and boo-hoo, because you don't know what you're talking about.
Yep. Badfinger, and I almost misspoke, because I believe, wasn't James Taylor the first signing by Apple?
Yes, he was.
Yeah, but the big signing was Badfinger.
Well, what had they hadn't had the hits when they were signed, though. They were known as the Ivies.
The Ivies, yeah. And they had a minor hit. But I don't think James Taylor had anything before he was signed to Apple. I think that was his first signing. So Badfinger was the big signing by the Beatles, you know, label that launched.
Right.
And like that Honey, Come and Get It, that song, that's all Paul McCartney. He played all the instruments. They just sang on it.
It was written. McCartney wrote it for a movie that Ringo was in with Peter Sellers, and the movie was called The Magic Christian, and they needed a song, and they were all tied in together in those days, and so there it is, Come and Get It.
Yeah. So they had a bunch of bad management situations. You know, not their record label wasn't really as fair as it should have been to them, but their managers were taking all their money. They were all living in one house.
I'm shocked, I tell you.
At one point in time. But Pete Ham, the lead singer and the main writer, ended up killing himself. And he hung himself in the garage.
Ergo, the witty references earlier to all the great hang songs they should have recorded. Tom Dooley. They should have done Tom Dooley.
Yes. Okay. And basically in the letter, he mentioned, I can't remember the manager's name, but he's like, you know.
Alan Klein.
No, it wasn't Alan Klein. But he's like, you know, I'll see you in hell, whatever your guy's name was.
Yeah.
So shortly after that, Tom Evans, who was his partner in forming the band, basically hung himself from a tree in the front yard.
Yeah.
And said, I'm going to be with Pete. So. And I met Joey Mollen, the guitar player of Badfinger, and he was the sweetest, nicest guy. And he's still kicking around on the road out there.
They keep him away from the ropes, but he's a good guy.
Yeah, he was affable. He was affable.
Well, he would have to be.
Yes.
Even if he wasn't, he would have to be because they've used up their quota of tortured.
that band story might be the saddest because they actually had big hits while they were together and never got any money.
Yeah.
And their tours were miserable. They got put on miserable tours.
Well, you said at the outset bad management decisions. Yeah. That's, you know, there's the difference because they obviously those songs. Not so much Without You, which Pete Ham wrote, but and became the big hit for Nilsson. The songwriting royalties on Without You alone would probably afford anybody a really wonderful living for the rest of their lives.
Oh, yeah, because Mariah Carey covered it, too.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, it's been cut.
Yeah.
It's like Yesterday. It's one of those songs that's not quite, but still of that ilk. But then you've also got Baby Blue, No Matter What. What's the other one I'm always thinking of?
No Matter What You Do.
And all those. And they still get a lot of airplay on oldies radio, so the royalties must be still rolling in somewhere.
To somebody. Yeah, to somebody.
That's just unfortunate.
Yeah, and that's really sad, but they were such a good band.
They were. And you know what? I'm replaying in my mind what I said a few minutes ago, my lack of compassion about suicide when things get all depressing and everything. And I started to say I was going to make an exception in the case of Pete and Tom. But you know what? No, I'm going to lump them in here too. Maybe it's just the mood I'm in. I'm thinking, you know, you're absolutely justified in feeling the way you do, given the fact that you're being fucked over by these business people who are robbing you blind. But if it had been me, and again, maybe this is just me at this age as opposed to them, they were still in their 30s, early 30s when they died?
Probably early 30s, yeah.
Okay. Perhaps they were just too young and too intimidated by the whole thing or overwhelmed by the whole thing. But at this point in my life, screw hanging me. I'd find those bastards and hang them from a tree and say, well, that takes care of my financial problem because now they're dead and I'm going to get all this shit straightened out.
Yeah, and according to Pete Ham's wife, I mean, they basically begged the management to give them money to live. I mean, they barely had any money to live.
Yeah. Could they? Yeah, okay.
And they got songs on the radio, and they're the, you know, from the outside looking in, they look like the.
Have there ever been any kind of documentaries about this?
No.
Because this lends itself to a wonderful. Even the questions that are screaming in my brain right now is did any of them ever occur to find perhaps a lawyer? Did nobody in the Apple organization or none of the living Beatles have the brains to say, well, let's talk to an attorney and get some work done for you guys on your behalf or something? There's a lot of holes in that story.
Well, I think the whole Apple experiment was so overwhelmed the Beatles because they didn't say we're going to form a record label and just sign artists and manage them. They had an electronics division with Magic Alex. They had an art division. They opened a clothing line store. Remember the Apple store that was on the corner in London. So they went in 10 directions at one time, and no direction was covered well.
Despite claims through the years that Magical Mystery Tour was, in fact, Paul McCartney's biggest vanity project ever. In truth, Apple was Paul McCartney's biggest vanity project ever.
And Paul McCartney said this of Pete Ham. He said, he may be one of the greatest songwriters who ever lived.
But see, that just makes it all the more infuriating. It's hard to believe that, because these guys were, they didn't live with each other, so it's not like they knew exactly what was going on an hour-to-hour basis.
Right.
But I find it hard to believe that in that time period, when Pete and Tom were having that much trouble, they were still associated. They were friends. Pete Ham had Paul McCartney's friggin' phone number.
Yep.
Pick up the phone and call him and say, Paul McCartney, I need you to drop a big hammer on these guys and help me. Not just give up and go hang yourself.
Well, it might be a situation. I'm sure you do too. I've got some famous people in my cell phone that I would never call. I'm afraid I wouldn't impose on them.
Well, then okay.
You see what I'm saying?
Well, no, because. I would be, if you said that to me and said, I'm not going to impose, my remark back to you would be, if you're talking about picking up the phone and saying, gee, Paul, would you give me $1 million? I'd feel imposed upon, but not the imposition of calling somebody who's in a position to turn you on to a damn lawyer.
That's true.
I'm not asking to pay for it. I'm asking you to steer me in the direction and help me out here so I can do what needs to be done.
What are they going to pay for it with?
Well, one thing, you know what I'm, it's, we're talking about a choice of paths.
Right.
And the path that he took and then the path that Tom took on the backside is that same business.
The path of least resistance, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And that's where it.
But yeah, they were an amazing band. If you, anybody listening in Indonesia, if you've never heard of Badfinger,
that's right.
Badfinger is, they're like the Beatles. They're literally just like the Beatles.
And Dave is the living embodiment of our expert monkeyologist when it comes to those questions. But here's a quick Beatle pop quiz question, but I bet you know the answer to. What was the name, the working title of the song that became With a Little Help from My Friends?
Oh.
That was not the name of the song as they were putting it together.
I know it wasn't. Oh, shit. And I know this, too. God damn it.
I wish I had the Jeopardy music.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, it's where the band took their name. They called it Badfinger Boogie.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
You see, you live a long time. You learn everything. All right, before we get depressed and hang ourselves, it's time to say bye-bye.
And now, the moment you've all been waiting for.
So glad we had this time together.
Oh, that is so lame.
Just so the rest of us know how much time is left.
Can you move it out of here?
Okay, wrap it up, kid.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The Audio Files.
All right, time to sum up all of our gratitudes, endorsements, news of the future, news of the world. What do you got? What's up?
Well, we wanted to thank everybody who came out to Paul Cullen from Badfinger. Bass player in Badfinger owns a listening room. We played a sold-out show at his listening room Saturday night. It was really cool. So thank you, Paul, and all of his staff. I'd like to thank Robbie and Lynn from Trinity Cymbals for all the connections and all the things they're doing for me. Sam and Kevin from HHG Drums. Iowa, Hello Indonesia from Solo Beat Drumsticks. And Nia Cox from Excess Energy Drinks. If you want some energy, boy, that vitamin B really kicks in. And the Teat Brothers, Dean and Dale. Dean and Dale Teat, two Delaware locations. You can catch them online. You can purchase any type of musical instrument. And then this Saturday, we are headlining the Drum DJ Show, which is Engine Number 9, is headlining Freeze Fest in Ridley, Pennsylvania. And it's go to freezefest.com. If you want tickets, there's hundreds of Freeze Fest events across the country. That's a big organization that does a nationwide concert series. And we're, if you look up the Ridley, Pennsylvania, you want tickets, you can get them there.
Cool.
What's going on with the podcast there, Scott?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I want to let everybody know I'm going to have a fungus looked at tomorrow. That's that's my age. Also, very exciting news. I didn't want to tell Dave this earlier because I wanted to spring it on him while we're right here on the air doing the old show. I've decided to do an end run on the state of West Virginia.
It'll only be a while, and you come home to West Virginia.
Because as like the ladies I know understand, there's only so many, so long you can wait for the phone to ring for the guy to call you. And then finally got to go, screw it. I'm going to go around and find it out. So what I did was I pitched the song Somewhere Else. And I said, you know, this is a hit because it should have been the state song of West Virginia years ago. And I've heard some favorable response. They haven't made a firm decision yet, but I'm just already imagining her putting her very special talents to work on her version of Come Home to West Virginia.
There's just no time to die.
You know, if you can't beat them. There you go.
Oh, Lord.
45 RPM with Scott Edward Phelps, the oldies. I call it Everything Oldies is New Again. You can find it wherever you found this podcast. Feel free to check it out. Welcome. I'd love to have you. The Sister Companion podcast that we do right here each and every week. The audio files, which are full versions of all the songs you've heard excerpts of along the way. And I mentioned last week, I'll mention it again. I don't want to hype it too much because I don't want to put a pressure or deadline for release because people will start clamoring. But I wrote a book a long time ago that I enjoy. It's kind of a memoir of my Nashville music songwriting days, and I enjoyed putting it together. I've had some high compliments through the years of people who've read the book. I've taken a lot of shit from Dave because there were no pictures in the book. But then I thought, well, I can do the next best thing. Audio speaking, I'm in the process of producing a podcast, which will consist of 8 or 10, I'm not sure yet, 10 episodes. It's kind of like an audio book in the form of a podcast. It's called I've Never Heard of You Either. And I'm projecting right now, what is this? This is almost February. I'm projecting it'll probably be available starting. The first episode will show up probably sometime in mid-February, maybe latter part. And then we'll do like all 10, one per week. It's kind of interesting. You might enjoy it. So I'll let you know more about
that
when
the
time comes. And then I'm going to spend an inordinate amount of time figuring out how to capitalize and make some cash on some of these things the way that Dave is ka-chinging his way all the way into retirement. While I'm getting absolutely not, I'm getting a sort of a qualified maybe from Billy.
There's just no time to die.
And her Oscar. We'd like to also say this and let this be the extent of it, okay? We see no problem at all with what's going on with Taylor.
None.
We're happy for her. She's a nice kid. He seems like a nice guy. Leave him the fuck alone.
And she's only on screen 15 fucking seconds, guys. Come on, man.
Now, the brother and the beer belly, that's a whole other story. We could talk about that another
time. I can't get enough of him.
And that's the world in which we live. Anything else?
Nothing else.
And good news, by the way. I don't have a yay thing on here, but I can tell you this. Next week, we are absolutely not going to do anything having to do with dead people. Because enough of that already. I'm Scott Edward Phelps.
I'm Dave Simmons.
And we are the Audio Files.
The Audio Files is produced in the United States of America. Questions, comments, and witty banter welcome. AudioFilesBroadcast@gmail.com.
And when I die, and when I'm gone, there'll be one child born in this world. Carry on, carry on.
The Audio Files.
That's all there is.